Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Good evening, everybody. Here's what I'd like for you to do, if you would. I want you to turn to the person sitting next to you, and I want you to tell them who you're voting for president and why, really quickly. Y'all don't want to do that? Can we just start over? That's about as awkward as going, hey, share your favorite sin, right? I mean, it's a tough one. And part of the reason why I want us to start there tonight, we're not going to talk about that, is that tonight's going to be a bit awkward, especially if you're a parent in the room. Where are the moms and dads? You're a parent in the room, okay? There's a ton of parents in the room. Are there any grandparents that are here? Awesome. There's some grandparents here. That's incredible. Are there teenagers or children in here? Okay. What's up? Okay. Let me tell you why being a parent is the hardest job in the world. You. Are there any single people? You are single. You be proud of it. Okay. That's okay. How many of you single people want to get married one day? Raise your hand. Okay. Look around, prospects, all right? So this is better than Tinder, okay? You don't even have to swipe. You can just go, well, hello. We're going to talk tonight about, we started this journey, if you were here last week, we talking about this idea of two pockets and trying to start a dialogue and a discourse for you and for me and for all of us in this room, because this is what we all know. None of us walked in here tonight wanting to be average or mediocre. And one of the greatest things among the bazillion things that Jesus offers us, he said in John chapter 10, verse 10, that I've come to give you life and life to the fullest. So one of the great promises of God is that he wants to give you abundant life. He wants to give you fullness of life. And what's interesting about all of us in this room that raised our hands as parents, what's interesting about all the grandparents in the room is that we also want to raise children who experience fullness of life. It's one of our greatest desires. It's part of the reason why so many of us in this room do the things that we do. And so the idea for a lot of us of experiencing or gaining fullness is that we think, as we talked about last week, and I wish this was my idea, it's not. A guy named Andy Crouch started articulating about this a couple of years ago. We think linearly that the idea of abundance or fullness is an idea of experiencing strength, a position of authority and power, and doing away with weakness. So what happens with so many of us in this room personally, and especially with what happens with a lot of us as parents, is that we kind of want to push against weakness. We want to push against weakness so that we experience constantly positions of strength, authority, and power, and we never experience vulnerability. We don't experience any sort of weakness. Now, here's the problem, and we said this last week. The problem with that is that everybody that we know that always operates from a position of power or authority or strength, we don't like. Nobody likes someone that's always right. Everything goes in, goes their way. We don't like them. And what's interesting about all of those people that are in this position is that you never really experience abundance. So maybe it's not what we said last week. Maybe it's not either or. Maybe it's and both. Maybe it's and both. And we've called this series Two Pockets for this reason. In the 18th century, there was a Jewish rabbi. He was Polish, but he was Jewish. And he started in his synagogue talking about this, that it would be a good idea for you to walk around with a piece of paper in one pocket and a piece of paper in another. Now, if you're here and you're going, well, why are we in a Christian church talking about Jews? Well, Jesus was a Jew, so chill out, okay? He was not British like all the movies make him out to be. Jesus was Jewish. And this rabbi had this idea. He came up with this idea that you should have one phrase in one pocket and one phrase in the other pocket. It looks like this in Hebrew. In the one pocket, it says, Ani Aha Wa'ahe, which sounds Indian, but it's actually Hebrew. It sounds like I've been watching Dances with Wolves, but Jamani Tatanka Owuchi. But it's Ani Aha Wahe, which means I am but dust and ashes. It's from Deuteronomy. And then on the other, Bishbili Nira Olam, which means for me, the universe was created. And so what his proposal was for us to operate this tension of holding ourselves in a place where we are constantly living in strength and weakness, the courage to risk, is that those times in our life when everything seems like it's just going incredible and we can't do any wrong and you're all that and a bucket of grease with a bag of chips and you got the t-shirt, is to remind yourself by pulling out of one pocket, I am but dust and ashes. And in those times where it feels like God has turned his back on you, when all hell is breaking loose in your life, it's a perfect time to pull out of the other pocket and remind yourself that for me, the universe was created. Now, there's some theological tension in that we're going to unwrap at the end of this series. But it's an incredible idea when you think about it for us to live in that tension, because most of us want to be, in fact, I think it's the curse of American Christendom that we want to come to an either or. And fullness of life, the abundant life, is found in the tension of the middle. And here's where we go tonight, because we hinted at this last week. All of us in this room, especially as parents, I want to speak specifically to parents tonight. All of us in this room as parents want our children to experience abundant life. In fact, when you had children, nobody prayed, God, there's not a dad here that says, God, I pray my son is just a very average athlete. That's what I pray. Nobody thought, I hope Sally's dumb. We don't do that. We want our children to experience life to the fullest as well. And everything is okay with that. Everything is cool in our life as parents, as long as everything is cool in life. But the problem with that idea, when you start studying the pages of Scripture, and if you just live, let's be family tonight. We are living in such a precarious time. We're living in a precarious time as a culture. We're living in a precarious time as a society. Every parent in this room can tell those of you that aren't parents, especially the parents of teenagers, especially the parents of high schoolers, that just the sexual saturation and the social media platform has changed the landscape for every mom and dad in this room, to the point that we are constantly feeling like we are treading on dangerous ground. It is a difficult thing to raise high school students in this culture. If you're the parent of a middle schooler, we pray for you all the time, because middle school in Hebrew translates hell, okay? That is a hard place to be. And if you're a middle schooler, I love you, but it's tough parenting you. I don't know if you realize this or not, but a sixth grade girl has 88 more hormone combinations than a woman in menopause. So that explains a lot. As long as everything is okay in life, most of us as parents go, I'm doing okay. But the problem with that premise is that everything is going to be okay all the time. And we have to reckon with the fact that the wisdom writer Solomon spent an entire chapter in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 saying this, that there is a time for everything. And he begins to list out, there's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to be joyful and a time to grieve. And the unspoken implication, if you aren't sure what he's saying, is that, ladies and gentlemen, look, life happens. It always has, and it always will. What that means is it leaves it up to you and I. How are we going to handle life? So Solomon says that there's a time for everything, and everything is going to happen, so life happens. And then Jesus comes along, hundreds of years later and says this, mark my word, in this world you will have trouble. He didn't say, it might get tough. Maybe. He said, in this world, you are going to face difficulty. And isn't that where, mom and dad, it's the most difficult to parent with the idea of parenting with fullness of life, the life that Jesus promised us to have in him? That's the place that it's the most difficult. Consider what Jesus' half-brother said. We looked at this briefly last week. James said this: how do you and I get to a place where we say about the trials and circumstances of life that we consider it? James implies that you and I, whether you're a parent or not, but I want to speak directly to parents tonight. James implies that you and I should consider it joy. Consider it joy. Joy is different than happiness. Happiness depends on what happens. Joy is a condition of your soul, which is already speaking to this idea of fullness of or abundance in us. And James says, consider it joy. He says, consider it pure joy. Brothers and sisters, when you face trials of many kinds, I want you to get this now. He did not say if. He said whenever. So the proverbial dookie, ladies and gentlemen, is going to hit the fan. Whenever you face trials of many kinds, he says, consider it pure joy, which begs a question: how? And even more importantly, why? Why do I consider it joy? Why do we consider it joy? Why do we consider it joy when this room is full tonight of moms and dads who are experiencing unbelievable turmoil as parents? And it doesn't matter what season of life you're in with your children. There are parents here who have rebellious children. There are parents here who have children with disability. There are parents here who have children who have made some incredibly poor, foolish choices that have brought on consequences that are beyond your wildest dreams and you would have never imagined. We live in a society and in an age where our parents here and your, you know, one or some child that you have has been molested, has been abused, has been raped, or even worse, has done those things to someone else. And you and I are to experience fullness in those kind of circumstances? How? Why? Why does James say consider it joy? Here's the reason why. Look at what he says next. Because you know that the testing of your faith, James says, produces perseverance. I do not travel and speak full-time for a living. There's not a bone in my body that wants to do that. I love my wife and my children way too much. I have a real job, and my real job, I work for an organization in which our mission is to fuse mom and dad back in the spiritual equation with their kids. Because in America, this is where we are as a country. We have started resourcing children to the church like we've resourced children to the school system. We take our kids to school and say, teach them how to read, write, and do math. And we take our kids to church and go, teach them God. But here's the heads up for every mom and dad in the room. Regardless of where you are in your season of life spiritually, you are the primary spiritual influence in your child's life. It's not the church's responsibility to disciple your kids. It's yours, sir. It's yours, ma'am. It's mine as a father. Even if I'm an awful spiritual influence, I'm still the primary spiritual influence in their life. And here's where we sit as a country. This generation of children and teenagers are the generation that does not handle adversity well at all. They quit way too easy. Not only do they quit in things in life, but they quit on their faith. And here's what I'd ask you to at least consider tonight. Maybe the reason why is because we want to do something good. I played basketball in college 50 pounds ago, and one of my college coaches, I don't think that's funny. sorry. I know, I could jump up in the air and get stuck. It's bad. But he used to call it false hustle. You're going 100 miles an hour trying to do the right thing, but you still make a mistake. He called it false hustle. And what we've done in the name of trying to help our children is that we have not allowed them to battle with consequences, whether they've been given or they've chosen them. And what James implies, that the reason why you and I should consider it joy when we face trials of many kinds, is because the testing of our faith produces perseverance. And our children, moms and dads, we adults in the room, every single one of us in this room need perseverance. Why? James explains why. Because he says, let perseverance, it needs to finish its work so that you may be mature, and here's the word, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Now, this word complete in James chapter 1 is different than the word for fullness or abundance in John chapter 10, verse 10, but there is a direct connection and correlation to them. In essence, what James is saying is that if you and I want our children, and if we want to experience life to the fullest, then we've got to figure out how to deal with circumstances, consequences, and difficulty. Because God seems to use those things to bring fullness of life, for you and I to experience life to the fullest. So here we sit, some of us with ordinary circumstances, other of us with very dysfunctional circumstances, some of us with tragic circumstances, and we all wish that life and our family could just be normal. Are there any Disney movie fans? If you're a parent in this room, you're probably going to raise your hand. I have, you know, two daughters and even our son. But I've watched so many Disney movies now. I can see a dad like holding his son up here, and immediately in my mind, I'm thinking, "Bah, Sabina!" You know, that's what I think. There's this Disney movie called The Incredibles. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but it's this movie about this family. Dad has supernatural powers. Mom has supernatural powers. The kids have supernatural powers. And there's a scene around the table at a meal. And I want you to listen to what the daughter Violet says in this scene. Watch the screens.
Don't think you've avoided talking about your trip to the principal's office, young man. Your father and I are still going to discuss it.
I'm not the only kid who's been sent to the office, you know.
Other kids don't have superpowers. Now, it's perfectly normal.
Normal?
For you.
What do you know about normal? What does anyone in this family know about normal?
Now, wait a minute, young
we
lady.
Act normal, Mom. I want to be normal. The only normal one is Jack-Jack, and he's not even toilet trained.
Lucky. Oh, I meant about being normal.
We act normal, but I want to be normal. We act normal, but I want to be normal. And isn't that impossible in our culture? Because every one of us in this room, our children, our families, have a story. And for most of us, that story has started a narrative of how we see life. And if you are a parent in this room, it's determined how you parent. In fact, most of us think this way. To take that linear line logic to the parenting spectrum, what we think, just like last week it was about being strong and being weak, what we think in parenting terms is that there is an extreme of being firm and an extreme of being warm. So we think in terms of, you know, firmness and warmth. If you're a firmness person, you love to bring up Proverbs 13, spare the rod, spoil the child. I mean, that's your verse. And so you lean into that way. If you're more of a warmth person, you're thinking about Ephesians and Colossians, where it talks about don't provoke a child toward anger. And so you lean this way. And what's interesting, and this is where the awkward bomb goes off, because no one is a parenting expert. I'm not standing in front of you as a parenting expert, because anyone who says they're a parenting expert is not a parenting expert. Because there's no such thing as a parenting expert. In fact, most people who claim to be parenting experts aren't parents. And what every parent in this room knows is that everyone that is sitting around us is imperfect in their parenting. Every grandparent in the room, I have had way too many conversations with grandparents who go, I wish I could go back and do things differently. Now watch, here's what's important, grandparents, because you now have a chance to speak into your own children's life about mistakes that you've made, because what we all tend to do, just like fullness of life, is to go to the extremes. And for most of us, we want to guard against firmness and push our children toward warmth. Our culture is screaming that we have a generation of children who feel a ton of warmth at home, but no firmness. And that is dangerous, not by my standards or opinion, but psychologists and sociologists are so much in agreement that it's not an either or. And if you and I are going to raise our children to experience life and life to the full that Jesus promised to give them, in him, it's not as much linear as it is, again, a quadrant, just like last week. And here's what we know. Here's what we know. And this is just for free. If you grew up in a home where your father or mother or both parents were authoritarian, I grew up in this home. I did not enjoy it at all. And one day I can come back and tell you stories. But I did not enjoy this. An authoritarian operates from a position of firmness, but never any warmth. Then there are those of us in this room that are indulgent parents. You operate from a position of warmth, but never any firmness. Know anybody like this? Because people that are indulgent parents wind up raising spoiled, entitled brats. Know anybody like that? Are they sitting beside you? Point at them right now. No, don't do that. Then there is the worst. It's the mom or dad that doesn't exercise firmness or warmth at all. And you become absent. And here's the heads up. You don't have to be absent from your home to be absent in your home. And if I may, to every man and dad in the room, it is our most dangerous temptation as dads to be so disconnected at home that we're in the home but we're absent. The goal, what's interesting, is that behavioral science parenting experts are pointing toward this. The goal is just like fullness. In fact, what they say is not nice parents, but kind parents. Because kindness, watch this, are people that are affectionate, are gentle, but they are firm. Those of us who decide, I am going to choose to be kind, are the parents that the data screams are raising children who are experiencing fullness in life. And we know this. In fact, next slide. If you've ever met anybody who comes from a home like this, firmness without warmth equals rebellion. You're looking at him. Some of us in this room, my dad was a military vet, and that's just the way he was raised, and so he did it. It's also interesting, isn't it, that if you were raised in an authoritarian home, you have a tendency, or authoritative home, authoritarian home, you have a tendency to go to the opposite extreme when you become a parent. And then the opposite is true. If everything was always warm fuzzies and do whatever you want to do, then you become a parent and you're like, we're going to have some structure in our house because I did whatever I wanted to do. So firmness without warmth leads to rebellion. Watch this. Warmth without firmness leads to entitled, spoiled brats. The goal is for you and I, as parents, to be kind parents. So that our children grow up in a home where the fullness and abundance of the life that Jesus is offering us becomes so apparent and transparent just by the way that we are parenting parents. But here's what makes that hard again. That is easy as long as everything is easy. As long as Bambi is running across the forest and flowers are popping up in the valley and Pocahontas is paddling down the river, everything is fine. But when you're experiencing circumstances that you have no control over, or life has gotten difficult, or your daughter is infatuated with some guy that has no business being in her life and you know it, and she will not listen to you, what do you do? What do you do when there are circumstances that you can't control? And I wish moms and dads and adults and teenagers and college students and young people, I wish that I could tell you that God will change your circumstances. But here's the heads up tonight. God doesn't promise to change your circumstances. He doesn't. In fact, if I may, God has shown a consistent ability to let circumstances play themselves out in your life and mine. Let me remind you of a story in the Old Testament. Some of you know this story. There is a Joseph in the Old Testament that was born the youngest of 12 brothers. I need to make sure that all of us understand this is the Joseph of the Old Testament, because I've talked about the Joseph of the Old Testament before, and somebody walked up to me afterwards, a man, and goes, dude, that was an incredible story, but where was Mary during that whole story? Okay, this is a different Joseph. This is not Joseph and Mary from the birth of Jesus Christmas. This is Joseph in the Old Testament, the son of Jacob. He's the youngest son of 12. Part of the reason why most of us know about this Joseph is because Joseph was the favorite son of Jacob. The reason why I think he was the favorite son for every man in the room is that Jacob had an ego and they had him very, very late in life. So in Jacob's mind, I still got it going on because I produce life. And so you're now my favorite. Not only that, but we know Joseph is famous because there's a Broadway play about him, because he was given this coat of many colors. That's that Joseph. But here's what was happening with Joseph as he was the favorite son, that Joseph started making enemies in his own home. So for everybody in this room who wants to hold up their circumstances and issues before God and go, this is awful, and I need you to take this away because there's no way that you can have another plan for what's going on in our house, consider this. Joseph begins to create enemies in his own home, in his own brothers. So much so, Joseph, he didn't help himself either. Do you have a child like this that wants to be so good that they tell on all the other siblings that aren't doing good? Are they sitting beside you, brother and sister, right now, and you just want to punch them in the face in the name of Jesus? We know you're good, so stop, Sally Spiritual. You know that person? Joseph had a bit of that in him. He was constantly pointing out all the things that his brother was doing wrong, and his mom and dad were going, oh, Joseph, and all of his brothers were going, man, I hate you. So much so that one day, Joseph's brothers are out tending to their father's work. Jacob sends Joseph to send them a message, and the scriptures say in Genesis that as Joseph is making his way to his brothers start having this conversation. Let's kill Joseph. So I know that things are tough at home, mom and dad, with your child, with your son, with your daughter, your teenager, but consider the dysfunction in this situation. All the sons are conspiring to kill their brother. Joseph gets closer. They're going, let's kill him. Let's kill him. Let's kill him. And one of Joseph's brother, a guy named Reuben, who became famous for a sandwich later, he speaks up and he says to his other brother, Club, listen. He says, listen, we do not need to kill our brother. Let's throw him in a well and think about this. So they show him mercy by throwing the youngest brother in a well. Now, the dysfunction only gets thicker because get this picture. Joseph, we don't know if he's conscious or unconscious in the bottom of the well. We don't know if there was water down there, if he's about to drown. But what we do know is his brothers stay up all night on top around the well having a cookout, talking out loud about what they're going to do with their brother. And they come to this decision when the sun comes up. Let's sell him into slavery. And I know your circumstances are bad, but are they that bad? So they sell Joseph, the youngest brother, into slavery. And who do they sell him to? We'll throw this up on the screens for you just so you can see it. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, so they sell him to some slave traders. The slave traders take him to Egypt, and a man named Potiphar, who's basically the general of the Egyptian army, buys Joseph to become a slave in Potiphar's home. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, keep going, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. And you would think at that point, there's no way. You know that if two pockets is happening right here, Joseph is pulling out, the universe has been created for me. The universe has been created for me. I've got the whole ashes and dust thing. But I want to remind myself, God, what about me? Have you forgotten about me? And a lot of us in this room, this is where we get as parents. It gets so difficult that you're just thinking, God has turned his back on me. He's written Ichabod over my house. He no longer cares about me. I am in trouble. And you would think that would be the case with Joseph. Except for what Genesis implies and declares to us. Because look at the next verse. He's a slave in an Egyptian general's house. And God was with him. Did God change his circumstances? No. In fact, you're going to see this in just a second. They got worse. But God was with Joseph, a Hebrew in a pagan land and a slave in a military officer's home. And he decides, I am going to live life to the fullest. I'm going to be a young man of integrity and character. And guess what it got him? Potiphar eventually gives him entire control of his entire home. The Lord was with him in the circumstances. Just like, maybe this is a reminder or a good checkup for you, or maybe this is encouragement that you needed tonight. Just like he's with you, mom and dad. He's with you. So Joseph earns this incredible position in this home. And you would think, okay, that's when the relief valve is pressed, and now I can go back to some sort of normalcy. And if we were to write this in our cinematic experience, then his parent, you know, his dad would come running in, riding in, and save him and take him back to, you know, to his homeland, and everything would be okay. It's not what happened. Guess what happened? Look what happens. Now, Joseph, the scriptures say, was a strikingly handsome man. Ladies, Joseph had it going on. He had it going on. Abs of steel, P90X, CrossFit training, he was spin class, he did it all. Six pack, eight pack, some of us prefer 2 quarts, but that's, I mean, Joseph had it going on. Joseph had it going on. He was a strikingly handsome man, and watch what happens. Potiphar has a wife, and as time went on, his master's wife, Potiphar's wife, became infatuated with Joseph, and one day, subtly just said, sleep with me. And she's not talking about, hey, let's have a sleepover. This is Real Housewives of Egypt County right here, okay? She says, sleep with me. Now, I want you to think about this. If you're Joseph, you're a Hebrew teenage boy in a pagan country. Egyptian women are gorgeous. Egyptian lover. Remember that song? They're gorgeous. He can do this, and no one will ever know. He can spend the rest of his days in Potiphar's house and walk by her every once in a while and just wink, and it will be their little secret. You talk about a circumstance. Because you know this has to be running through his mind. But what if I say no? And most of us are going, where's God? Stuart, you're implying that God is with Joseph in that circumstance? Well, first of all, look at how Joseph responds. But Joseph, he wouldn't do it. Because he believes that there is life and life to the fullest, and I don't need to go there. And what did this decision of unbelievable, impeccable integrity and character get Joseph? Potiphar's wife tells a lie, tells her husband that Joseph made a move on her. Potiphar gets ticked off, throws Joseph into prison for something that he didn't do. And when he gets thrown in prison, you're thinking this, that's where God completely disintegrates out of the circumstance. He's no longer in it. And just like me, we've reached the tipping point. God has turned his back on us. That's exactly where God bolted. Unfortunately, this is what the next verse says. The Lord was with him even when he got thrown in prison. And what happens with Joseph? What Joseph decides to do is, I am just like I was in Potiphar's house. I'm going to be a young man of integrity and character. He begins to be so full of integrity and character that the prison warden basically gives him run of the prison. Joseph had this incredible gift to interpret dreams. One day, Pharaoh, the ruler of the Egyptian empire, the most powerful man on the planet at this point, one day Pharaoh decides, I need a dream interpreted. Can anybody help me? They go, hey, there's this young Hebrew boy in prison, call him. He interprets the dream correctly. And Joseph, who's been sold out by his brothers into slave trade, slave traders sell him into Potiphar's house. He gets, you know, hit on by Potiphar's wife. She lies on him and blackmails him, and he still stands for what is right, gets thrown into prison. He explains and interprets Pharaoh's dream correctly, and Pharaoh decides, if I may, to summarize, Joseph, you are now the second most important, powerful person in the entire kingdom of Egypt. The only person that is ahead of you is me. And Joseph's story screams at all of us as parents and even those that aren't. This fundamental idea, everybody look, that maybe God doesn't want to change your circumstances because he's really interested in using them. Maybe God isn't changing what you're going through with your kids because God wants to use what you're going through with your kids. And watch this. The reason why God wants to use what you're going through with your kids is because what you're going through with your children, what your children are going through, is a part of the process of you experiencing life abundantly. Because it is a circumstance, a trial, that is testing your faith, producing perseverance, so that you can be mature and full, not lacking anything. There is not one single circumstance, we'll throw this up on the screen. There is not one circumstance that the sovereign, providential, all-powerful hands of God can't take. Not one single circumstance that he can't take and touch and make them epic and beautiful, regardless of how ugly you think they are. He can do that in the circumstances that you're experiencing right now as a mom, as a dad, as a couple, as parents, and for all of us in this room. And I know some of you are going, but you don't understand how trapped I feel. First of all, yes, I do, because I'm a parent. I'm with you. You don't understand how trapped I feel. If I may, being trapped in a circumstance is a position. It's not your fate. It's not your fate. It's only a position that you're in. It's a season. It's not a curse, and it is not your fate. Because what I am discovering as a parent as well is, if I can have a clear why this is happening, I can deal with any how. And when I start realizing that the circumstances that are happening in all three of Kelly's and my children's lives is for their good, my good, their fullness, my fullness, and the glory of God, I can deal with any how because I'm starting to understand why. So if I may, Stuart, what do I do? Let me ask you two questions, and these will be great for you to talk about as you leave here and go to Starbucks and grab coffee or whatever. Here's number one. Are you standing on God's shoulders? Are you standing on God's shoulders? What do you mean? Here's what I know. The higher that you and I get, the more different a perspective you gain. If I were to ask all of you in this room to stand up on your chair, which I'm not going to do, but if I were to ask you to, here's what I know. Your perspective of things on the floor would change. The higher that you get, things below you get smaller, and you are able to see more. When I am standing on God's shoulders, I am able to see things from his perspective. And if I can see things from God's perspective, I'm much more apt to do what it is that God says to do. So with your particular circumstances, parents, are you standing on God's shoulders? Here's the second thing. Have you made a plan for the circumstances that you're in? Or, better stated, have you made a plan for your circumstances, period? We have in real time, in real life, as a family, experienced this past year. I mentioned my wife Kelly and I have a son who's about to graduate from college. He's in his senior year. We have a daughter who just graduated from high school, and then our youngest daughter will be a sophomore in high school this year. Our oldest daughter, who just graduated from high school, is a really, really good basketball player. She's going to play basketball in college. Her junior year, she and her team won the 4A state championship in Georgia. Her sophomore year, they played in the state championship game and lost by 3 points in an incredible game. And then going into her senior year, if you were an athlete in high school, you understand this. Or if you were a senior at one point in high school, you understand this. She was the only senior on her team, on a very, very talented team that had an opportunity to go back to back and win two consecutive state championships and go to the state championship game 3 consecutive years. So she's the only senior. They're really, really talented. She's feeling all of this, you know, pressure to lead and to be that person. She's committed to go and play basketball in college. And 7 games into her senior year, she, on a run out, she runs ahead. Our point guard throws it ahead to her, and Chandler grabs the ball as she's coming down. She's trying to jump back. She caught the ball under the goal, and so she's trying to jump backwards. And I pray that not one single parent ever has to hear the scream that came out of my daughter's mouth. And to watch her, I mean, to watch her crumble to the ground, just screaming in pain. And then to get back to the training room with her and our trainer look at her and say, "Sweetheart, you've torn your ACL. You're done." And just to watch her heart break. I was broken. And she wept uncontrollably 3 to 5 minutes. There was nothing that I could say, my wife could say, her sister could say that could console her. She was broken. And I can't explain it, I don't understand it, but at about the 4.5-5 minute mark, a switch flipped. And she went from and she sat up and she goes, "Okay, what do I need to come back? What do I need to do to come back? What do I gotta do? I'm gonna be a better leader than I ever, I'm gonna be a better leader than I ever have been. I'm gonna come back faster than anybody's ever seen anybody come back. I'm gonna come back stronger than anybody's ever seen anybody come back." And I wish I could tell you that that flip of the switch was because her dad was so unbelievably godly. I wish I could tell you that. But we're in church and that would be a lie. That's not true. I will tell you that her mom is unbelievably godly. But I'll also tell you that somehow, some way, in our daughter's heart, she had been planning, and it flipped. She had a plan for her circumstances. I have never been more proud of any of our children watching her lead when she couldn't play. Watching her being up at 5 o'clock in the morning and going to rehab and doing it 3 times a day. She was back running full speed in 6 weeks after surgery. She had a plan, and she had her mother's genetic makeup. That helped, but I mean, it's true. She just had a plan. What's your plan for your circumstances? Because maybe God doesn't want to change them because he wants to use them. And how does he want to use them? He wants you to consider, would you just extend your circumstances to me and allow my providential, all-powerful, all-knowing, supernatural power do magic with this junk that has happened in your life? And why does he want to do that? Because he wants you to experience life to the fullest in abundance. And it only happens if you go through trials. And for you to try to skirt them is you actually deciding, I really don't want life to the fullest as much as I think I do. So what is that thing in this dark time in your life, in this dark season of life? Or it's dimming. Or maybe it's ordinary. Can God take my ordinary circumstances and use them? Let me give you a real life illustration of this, and then we'll get out of here. You can throw that picture up. In my opinion, pound for pound, Muhammad Ali was the greatest boxer to ever live. In my opinion. Now, you can disagree with me, and this is America, you have the right to be wrong, but in my opinion, Muhammad Ali was the greatest boxer to ever live. He was big, he was long, he was fast, he was quick, he was skilled. I love the fact that he was the first athlete to talk smack. He made that a big deal. Cam Newton and all that dab stuff, that was Muhammad Ali. That came from Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali would say things like this: if you ever dream about beating me, you better wake up and apologize. Because I float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Your hands can't hit what your eyes can't see. I'm a pretty man. I'm bad. I mean, that was him. Loved him. In fact, my oldest daughter, while she was hurt, we watched for 2 hours replays of Muhammad Ali's fights. His first two fights when he was still Cassius Clay against Sonny Liston were just things of beauty. If boxing can be beautiful, it was beautiful. And most of you are going, what does this have to do? Stuart, you are so ADHD. We're talking about parents. And then we went to Joseph. Now you're going to Muhammad Ali. It's like squirrel. I mean, listen. It has everything to do with you. And it's impacted you more than you realize. Because on March the 25th, 1975, next picture, in Cleveland, Ohio, the three-time world champion and, in my opinion, the greatest boxer of all time, fought a down-and-out fighter named Chuck Wepner. Chuck Wepner's nickname was the Bayon Bleeder. Not because he beat people up so bad that they bled, but because he got beat up so bad that he bled. They called him the Bayon Bleeder. He was a down-and-out fighter fighting the greatest of all time. And what makes this fight famous is that in the ninth round, Chuck Wepner knocked down Muhammad Ali. Now, you can tell from the picture, reality is he stepped on his foot and Muhammad Ali tripped and fell. But Chuck Wepner thought, I've knocked him out. In fact, Chuck Wepner tells this story. Ali is crumbling to the ground, and Wepner turns with his hands up and begins to yell in his corner. He yells at Al, his manager, Al, start the car. We're going to the bank. We're going to be millionaires. Because in his mind, he's just knocked out the champion of the world. He has his back to Ali, Wepner does, and his trainer looks around him and says, well, you better turn around because he's getting up and he's mad. Words do no justice to how badly Muhammad Ali beat this man for the next 6 rounds. He was so angry that he had gotten knocked down / tripped that he beat the living daylights out of Chuck Wepner. By the end of the fight, Wepner's face looked like hamburger meat. 30 seconds until he goes into the last round, 30 seconds, they called it TKO. But Chuck Wepner went down. His claim to fame is that he made it 15 rounds with the greatest boxer of all time. To which you're going, that still does not matter to me. But it does. Because this was 1975, before there was such thing as cable television or pay-per-view, and the only way you could watch a fight like this if you lived in some other state or city is if by chance a major network decided to show it in a select theater. And it just so happened on March the 25th, 1975, in Los Angeles, California, they were showing that fight. And sitting in that theater, next picture, was a starving actor named Sylvester Stallone. He watches this fight and he has this thought as he's watching it. What if I wrote a script about a champion boxer who would be the epitome of Muhammad Ali? I'll call him, next picture, Apollo Creed. And he fights a down and out, no good bum boxer. And I'll call him next picture, Rocky Balboa. He leaves the theater, and in 3.5 days, on 90 pieces of paper and a spiral notebook, he writes the script and titles it Rocky. Was Sylvester Stallone down and out? Next picture. How many of you have seen any of the Rocky movies? Raise your hand high. Look around you. Do you remember his dog's name? Butkus. His dog's name was Butkus. In real life, this was Sylvester Stallone's real dog. Before Sylvester Stallone moved to Los Angeles, he was living in New York. He and his wife were starving because he couldn't get any acting gigs. He had this giant dog in this tiny apartment in New York, and he sold the dog for $50 to some guy on the street because they just needed food. You fast forward. After he's written the script, Rocky, he has his hand on the doorknob after another failed casting call, and he looks to these film producers and he says, I also happen to write. Would you be willing to read one of the scripts that I've written? They said, sure. He brings them the Rocky script, and they buy the Rocky script for somewhere around $400,000. He immediately gets on a train, goes back to New York, and tries to find the guy who has Butkus. He finds him. Somehow, the guy that he had sold Butkus to for $50 had heard that he had sold a movie script. He had to buy Butkus back for $15,000. But he bought him back, and he put him in the film because he said, he's an expensive actor. Think about this for just a second. Most of us in this room, you just raised your hand and you've said, I've seen one of the Rocky films. This movie has become such a phenomenon in our culture that we could hear a couple of bars of a song and we want to start shadow boxing, right? There's something in you that just wants to, you want to hit something, right? I mean, you're just like, that's enough, because there are ladies, right? I'll scratch your eyeballs out, right? You just want to fight. There are men right now thinking, I'm going to go put on sweatsuit and run around Wilmington and try to find some steps somewhere. Rocky 1, Rocky 2, Rocky 3, Rocky 4, we wish Rocky 5 had never been made, Rocky Balboa. And 10 years after the first Rocky came out in 1976, 10 years later in 1986, in the ghetto of Oakland, California, a young man named Ryan Coogler was born. Next picture. Ryan Coogler was born into a family. His father was a Rocky Balboa fanatic. Ryan Coogler grew up playing basketball and football, and his dad would make him watch Rocky II before every one of his games. Ryan Coogler graduates from high school, goes to college, goes to film school, becomes a film producer and screenwriter. And his dad became deathly ill. And as he's battling with his dad's illness, he asked himself this question one day: what would my dad's hero, Rocky Balboa, do if he became sick? And he had a thought. What if I wrote a script and Apollo Creed had a son and Rocky Balboa was sick, but he winds up training Apollo Creed's son? Next picture. And that movie is Creed. And if you haven't seen it, you should, because it's brilliant. Think about this. Two men in incredibly dire circumstances that just go, here. And I'm not implying that it was God. But can we all agree that something has happened to make these things history makers? And watch this, mom and dad. I may never be a history maker myself, but I can raise them. I can raise history makers. And part of the way that you raise a history maker is by teaching them that in your circumstances, when it gets hard, whether you've chosen what you've gotten or it's something you didn't even deserve, Just go, God, please. Can we think about this for just a second and then I'll let you go? Last picture. Anybody ever been to Philadelphia? I've been to Philadelphia several times. For those of you that needed a history refresher course, Philadelphia is where the Liberty Bell is. It's where Liberty Square is. It's where the Declaration of Independence was signed. And supposedly it's where Betsy Ross made the first flag. The first two times I went to Philadelphia, I didn't want to see the Liberty Bell. I didn't want to go to Liberty Square. I didn't want to go in the house that where they signed the Declaration of Independence. I had very little interest in Betsy Ross's house. I wanted to go and run museum steps and find the statue of a boxer who isn't even real. The tourist department of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania will tell you that the most visited attraction in their city is not Liberty Square, the Liberty Bell, or Betsy Ross's house. It is the National Museum of Art steps and this statue of Rocky Balboa, who wasn't even a real person. And guess where that comes from? Someone in dire circumstances just going here. God doesn't want to change your circumstances because he wants to use them. And he wants to use them so that you can have life to the fullest. And to do this is you deciding, I don't want the abundant life. Because the testing of your faith produces perseverance, and perseverance has to finish its work so that you can be mature and complete. So tonight, Spirit of God, here's what I ask for all of my friends here. In those times when it seems like everything is going perfectly for us as parents, would you remind us to reach in our pocket and remind ourselves that we are nothing but dust and ashes. And in those times, it seems like we are in these times more than any God, where all hell has broken loose and our circumstances seem to be over our head and we're drowning. Would you remind us that you have created the universe for us to exist for your glory, for your purposes? Help us to live from two pockets. Help us to parent from two pockets. And we pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen.